Tonight, the preseason games get rolling. It's the closest thing to real football until 4 weeks from tonight when the Seattle Seahawks host the Green Bay Packers, the first regular season game of the year. It's on NBC. Plenty to talk about as the season approaches. And the big rule change, it's not really a rule change. It's a point of emphasis. It's a renewed point of emphasis. It's the 10-year anniversary of the last time the NFL made illegal contact and defensive holding a point of emphasis. That time around, it happened in large part because former Colts GM Bill Polian complained about the manner in which the Patriots' defensive backs were mugging and tugging and holding and pushing and shoving Peyton Manning's receivers when they were more than 5 yards downfield. Polian at the time, a member of the competition committee, very influential, in position to push that through. Now, on one hand, it resulted in a dramatic increase in fouls for illegal contact and defensive holding from 79 in 2003 to 191 in 2004. On the other hand, it really didn't change anything because the Patriots repeated as Super Bowl champions in the 2004 season. So they adjusted, or even if they didn't adjust, they still thrived and succeeded as a team that was able to get back to the Super Bowl and win it. Now, 10 years later, it's been 10 years since the Patriots have won the Super Bowl, but this time around it didn't happen because of the Patriots. It happened because of the Seahawks. And it was clear last year that the Seahawks were gaming the system. Nothing wrong with that because, look, it's only a foul if the flag is thrown. If they don't throw the penalty flag, it's not a penalty. So you get away with what you can. And the Seahawks cracked the code. They figured out that the officials will not throw flag after flag after flag after flag for illegal contact and defensive holding because it will bog the game down. There's so many commercial breaks we have to get in. There's so much time within which a game needs to be played. We cannot allow the game to slow down and miss that three-hour window, extend that three-hour window because we're throwing a flag on every play. The NFL has responded by making, once again, reiterating the emphasis on something that shouldn't need to be emphasized because the rules are the rules. This whole point of emphasis thing is the closest the NFL will ever come to admitting that they have been screwing it up on a systematic basis. You don't need to emphasize something that's in the rule book. It's in the rule book. And I say from time to time, I don't like the fact that the rules say one thing and they're applied a different way. This is a prime example that the rules aren't applied as written, or at least they haven't been applied as written. They were applied as written back in 2004 when the flags went from 79 to 191. Since then, they've gotten away from it. And it's amazing that there was no emphasis during the season in 2013 when it was clear this is what the Seahawks were doing. They have regular communications, emails, meetings, phone calls, etc. Why not say to the officials during the season, hey, guys, we're not enforcing the rules as written. We need to enforce the rules as written. Well, this year they're going to enforce the rules as written. And referees like Ed Hockley, Gene Steratore have expressed confidence that the adjustments will be made quickly in the preseason and the regular season. I'm not buying it. I don't think the adjustments are going to be made. But that's one of the things to watch as the preseason games begin. Will the flags fly for illegal contact and defensive holding? And will teams adjust? Will the Seahawks adjust? Richard Sherman has shrugged it off. Pete Carroll, respect. Bottom line is, if you don't adjust, you're going to draw a lot of flags unless this point of emphasis doesn't last for very long. But last time around, 79 to 191. This time around, we'll see what happens. Hard Knocks, something that was around 10 years ago, although it started as Hard Knocks, and then it was like inside training camp with the Jaguars, and then it was Hard Knocks again, and then it went away, and then it came back. And what they should have done, they should have pulled the plug on the thing after the Jets in 2010. They're never going to duplicate what they pulled off in 2010 with Rex Ryan and the New York Jets. Since then, well, they didn't have it in 2011 because of the lockout. Then 2012, it was the Dolphins, and Chad Ochocinco Johnson made it a little more intriguing. Last year with the Bengals, not bad. This year, did people even really know it was debuting this week? Is it creating any buzz whatsoever? And some of that may be PR, but some of it also may be that the Falcons are just a boring team. And I think they like being a boring team. They agreed to do this because the NFL wanted them to do it. They weren't one of the eight teams that could be tapped on the shoulder and forced to do it. They stepped up and volunteered because the NFL had been pushing them to do it. I just don't know that this is a team that is going to generate a whole lot of interest and a whole lot of buzz and a whole lot of attention for Hard Knocks. And the NFL has signed a long-term deal to continue to do Hard Knocks. Maybe the joke's on HBO. Maybe HBO should want to rip this thing up eventually if they don't get a more intriguing team. The Falcons are not an intriguing team. They're not. And That's just the way it is. Now, they may be very intriguing come January if they go 13-3 and they're back in the playoff mix and they're able to win some playoff games and hold leads in the postseason. But for now, I look at the Atlanta Falcons and I say, I really don't care right now. I may care in September, October, November, December. But as of right now, I really don't care about the Atlanta Falcons. And yeah, I'm too cheap to get HBO. But in past years, I have made sure that I get in touch with people at HBO to get me a copy of the DVD as soon as possible. And they've been very good about that. This year, I don't even care. I haven't even asked. They haven't offered. I haven't asked. I don't care. And if I don't see a single episode of this year's Hard Knocks, I don't feel like I'm going to miss anything. Because I didn't watch it Tuesday night, and I don't feel like I missed anything. And I don't plan to watch it. And even if they send me the DVDs, I don't know that I'm going to watch it. I don't know. They need a team like the Steelers. They need a team like the Giants. They need the Jets again with Rex Ryan. They should have done it in New Orleans with the Saints and Rob Ryan. They're broadcasting a week ago. I could hear Rob in the background using the same kind of language that made the 2010 edition of Hard Knocks even more intriguing because Rex was involved. So they have to do something. And this whole formula, well, there are certain teams every year that we can... Well, you know what? Here's the best way to make it interesting. Here's the best reality show that HBO and NFL Films could do. Draft a team that doesn't want to do it. The Arizona Cardinals have said, we don't want to do it. Bruce Arians, the head coach, says he could be kicking and screaming. That's the team you want. You want the reluctant participant in the reality show to be the subject of the reality show. Maybe it will be more real if that's the case. Because that's the thing about reality shows. As long as people know cameras are there, it's really not reality. I remember a couple of years ago, Joe Philbin of the Dolphins talking about how, oh, you just, you know, this is how we really are. No, it's not how you really are because the camera's on. The only way we know how you really are is when the cameras aren't on. The cameras will be on the Patriots tonight as they play Washington. Ryan Mallett will get the start at quarterback because Tom Brady won't play. We're going to talk more about Tom Curran, about some of these dynamics, but this is Ryan Mallett's opportunity. This is his fourth year. This is his contract year. This is his opportunity to get noticed, not in order to play for the Patriots this year. He's not going to supplant Tom Brady. This may be the only time we see any of Ryan Mallett throughout this preseason. That's it for Ryan Mallett. That's his closing argument to go to the marketplace next year. But there's still a possibility, and I don't know how big of a possibility. But let's say Ryan Mallett plays really well in the preseason. Let's say, for example, that Ryan Fitzpatrick of the Texans doesn't play very well in the preseason. And let's say Jimmy Garoppolo, second-round pick of the Patriots this year, also does enough to allow the Patriots to feel confident that Garoppolo could be the backup to Tom Brady. I still think it's possible that Mallett gets traded to the Texans because he knows the offense. And I know you want to have a guy there for as long as possible to get to know the receivers, et cetera, et cetera. But look, Ryan Fitzpatrick, who I have a lot of respect for, friend of PFT. I remember he once found out that he got traded, not through anyone with the team that traded him, but via a post we had on the website, and we've had him on the show. But when the Titans have the guy under contract for $3.25 million and they choose not to keep him around, how does that make him the surefire can't-miss starter for the Houston Texans? I think Ryan Mallett has an opportunity. If Garoppolo plays well enough to show that he can be the backup, I think Ryan Mallett has an opportunity to maybe create some late offseason, preseason, pre-regular season buzz for a possible trade that would get him an opportunity to play this year. It all hinges in large part on what he does in the preseason. And he gets the opportunity to come out of the gates as the starter with the rest of the starting offense. Let's see what Ryan Mallett can do. And I know it's a preseason. It's a glorified scrimmage. There's no game planning, yada, yada, yada. But still, these are live reps. This is an opportunity to show what he can do and maybe end up with a new team. We're going to continue the discussion of the New England Patriots when we come back from the break. Tom Curran of CSN New England will join us, and I'll talk, you know, is Brady injured? What's going on? How did the joint practices go with Washington? Are they looking forward to the joint practices with Philadelphia, given that cornerback Kerry Williams continues to say that the Patriots are cheaters? And all sorts of other stuff regarding the New England Patriots. And then we're going to talk to you. We enjoy it. We hope you enjoy it. It's the segment that we typically wrap the show with, the PFT Planet segment. We'll answer your questions via Twitter and via phone. We had a lot of calls yesterday. We'll see if we get a lot of calls today. Before that, we'll get a call from or place a call to Tom Curran of CSN New England. We'll talk to Tommy after the break. This is PFT Live. That's Ryan Mallett, who has largely become a forgotten man in the NFL. He fell down to round three in 2011. He's entering the final year of his rookie contract, and he gets the start tonight when the Patriots take on Washington to cap several days of joint workouts. Joining us now to talk about that and all things Patriots, our good buddy Tom Curran of CSN New England. And Tom, let's start with Mallett. Before we talk Mallett, I said let's start with Mallett, but let's not start with Mallett. Let's start with why Mallett's playing. What's up with Tom Brady? Why is he not going to play tonight?
You know, the great thing for an NFL team about having these joint practices, and Bill Belichick pointed it out, is you can orchestrate completely what you do during those practices. And Belichick pointed out that you can do 35 third down plays or 25 red zone plays on a given day and give your players more opportunity, your ones more opportunity to see situations that will impact them in the regular season against another team's ones than you'll ever get in the preseason. Tuesday, the Patriots and Redskins took advantage of that. They had almost a three-hour practice. Brady was out there for a huge chunk of it. So that's one reason you won't see Brady. The second reason is the showcase of Ryan Mallett. And I think that, you know, I'll let you follow because I have a tendency to talk too long when I get on with you without breathing. So I'm going to let you ask another question.
I've never complained.
All right, then I'm going to keep going.
No. But since you stopped, let me ask you the question. When you say showcase Ryan Mallett, do you mean there's a chance that they may trade Ryan Mallett? Because I think there's still a chance they could trade him.
Yes, I think it's absolutely a likelihood that that would be their preferred course of action with Ryan Mallett. And I'm just posting a story now trying to explain it. Ryan Mallett has been nothing but an excellent citizen for them since he came into the league with a swirl of drug rumors and off-field problems around him that dropped him to the third round. He's gone back to Arkansas. He finished his degree. He's gone from an aloof kid to a really engaging kid. He knows the offense. It's his on-field performance that is the niggling detail that makes it hard to say, yeah, ready to go. His accuracy still isn't there sometimes. He's still got a little bit of a long release. And if the Patriots are going to prime the pump for Ryan Mallett to be dealt for, you've got to get him out there, not throwing to Wilson Van Hooser and Derek Johnson. You've got to get him out there throwing to Amendola and Edelman and Kenbrell Tompkins, behind a number one offensive line, for people to say, oh, yeah, well, that's the way it's supposed to look. It's starters against starters, and now we see what Ryan Mallett can do. And I absolutely do not think it was a coincidence that Mike Mayock, who's a good friend of Bill Belichick, kind of primed the pump earlier this week with his comments about Ryan Mallett, because not just to me, but, you know, virtually to everybody in the media, it was a very pedestrian Ryan Mallett day, almost, you know, distinguished only by his mediocrity. And Mike Mayock saying that Ryan Mallett popped and was a legitimate NFL starting quarterback after that day, it came out of left field.
So if he would be traded, I look at the Texans because this late in the offseason, a guy in a contract year, you want to go to an offense that you know, coach you're familiar with, Bill O'Brien now taking over in Houston, Ryan Fitzpatrick, the current starter. Is it too obvious that it's Houston, or is there someone else out there?
Boy, I think you'll have a better grip on that than I, because when I look at the number of different things that can happen, if Mallett goes out and poops the bed tonight and Garoppolo shows some signs of aptitude, then the likelihood around the league is that those teams will say, you know what, he doesn't look that good. You know, we'll wait until he gets released. Then it becomes kind of a situation where teams will get into, do we need him now? And I said this yesterday, it is as important as his four-year college career, what happens tonight at FedEx Field and next week against the Philadelphia Eagles. This is critical for Ryan Mallett in terms of shaping where he'll be and the swirl around him in the anticipation, because he still has that arm, Mike. I mean, Blaine Gabbert has had his shot and washed out. Christian Ponder has had his shot and washed out. Jake Locker's on his last legs. Kaepernick, Dalton, and Cam Newton are all established stars or well-paid guys in the league. Ryan Mallett has as good an arm as any of them, except for maybe Kaepernick and maybe Newton, and he still hasn't gotten his shot. So they have to build that trade value, and I think it could be league-wide.
But it also has to be, if there is trade value, Mallett has to look good. But also Garoppolo has to show that he could be the backup to Brady, right? I mean, if Garoppolo comes out and, to borrow your quite eloquent term, poops the bed, then Garoppolo can't be number two. You need to – and no pun intended. If he poops the bed, he can't be number two. So then Ryan Mallett ends up, by default, remaining as the backup.
We never disappoint with a nice highbrow conversation.
That's true. This is very sophisticated.
And it goes well beyond what people will look at. Well, Garoppolo went 4 for 6. He looked pretty good. It goes so far beyond that for these coaches. I think on every sideline, not just the Patriots. How does a guy communicate with the sideline? How well does he get the calls out to his wide receivers and backs and get the calls in from his offensive linemen in terms of protection? Does he get the team in and out of bad plays? Does he move quickly in and out of the huddle? Does he make good post-snap reads? You know, they're not even going to be really into checking out of plays and into other plays. That doesn't generally happen until the third game of the preseason. Even if your play is doomed to failure, you run it anyway. Generally speaking, that's what the Patriots have done. But can he do all those things? I think it'll go past passing stats. It'll be a very subtle evaluation. But if he can't do it, you can't hold the whole damn team hostage in a month and say, yeah, well, hopefully if Brady gets hurt, Garoppolo can do something. You can't do that. This team is too talented right now and too close to the top of the league to leave it in the hands of Jimmy Garoppolo, no matter how handsome he is.
And just to finish on this topic, bring it back to where Tom Brady would play if it were a regular season game, correct? This isn't some Tony Romo situation where maybe he's 100%, maybe he's not, maybe his back screwed up, maybe it isn't. Brady's healthy. This is more about Mallett and Garoppolo tonight, correct?
Yep, and the fact that Brady got all his, as Brady said, I might have gotten 80 or 90 reps and looks on Tuesday. So he's all set with preparation this week.
Okay, now, we talked about briefly receivers. You mentioned receivers. Brady has sung the praises of Brandon LaFell, who is not like the quote-unquote little pygmies that he has in Danny Amendola. And I almost said Wes Welker, but Julian Edelman. I'm looking at the depth chart. Whoever put the depth chart together, and I know these things are largely worthless, but it's something. I'm looking at it, and it has Brandon LaFell running third string behind Aaron Dobson and Kemble Tompkins. How do you see the depth chart shaking out at receiver?
Since they're so multiple and specific, and if you look at some of the combinations, the Patriots were off the charts in terms of the number of combinations used. The depth chart isn't as important as the deployment, as you certainly well know. I think there's going to be – LaFell has carved a niche. Okay, he's a different player than Kenbrell Tompkins, who I think is an outside receiver almost strictly. But LaFell can work inside and outside and along the sidelines because he's bigger than Tompkins. But I think Tompkins is a better downfield target because of his speed than Aaron Dobson. So it depends on what your situation is. One guy who has, to borrow a phrase from Mike Mayock, popped this week has been Danny Amendola. He had a tremendous week. And that's not that Julian Edelman hasn't, but Edelman gets so many looks from Brady that sometimes Amendola, you know, just running routes on his own. This week he got a lot of looks from Brady and had a very good week. So I think Amendola, Tompkins, Edelman, and LaFell are all in the mix there as your top four. Dobson, other people are higher on him than I am. I think he's a good player. I think he's going to have a place on the team, but this stress fracture that included having, I think, a screw put into his foot is going to probably take a little while.
Do you see the Patriots making any moves at receiver or, more importantly, tight end based on who gets cut, who may be available in trade, who's still out there in free agency?
Yeah, I'm trying to ferret out any information on whether or not Dustin Keller or JerMichael Finley might still be in their plans. Obviously, Keller, I think. I don't want to speak out of turn. Finley is still available, correct?
Yes, Finley's still available.
Okay, so I think Keller would be the more likely of the two. They've had both of those guys in there. Now the Patriots had Gronkowski stayed behind in New England. DJ Williams, who was a Mackey Award winner in 2010 at Arkansas and has bounced around the league, was basically their number two since Michael Omanawa knew he went down. DJ Williams got rolled up on this week, so now they have this 6'8 kid named Justin Jones playing the tight end spot at the top of the roster. Undrafted kid, interesting prospect, 6'8, has like a 37-inch vertical, but he still plays very robotically. I think the Patriots are going to have to address the tight end spot depth-wise during this training camp because if Fuhrman's down and Gronkowski's still tender, you need to be able to field the damn team for the preseason at that position. It's such a critical spot. So I wouldn't be surprised if Keller or Finley are fully good to go if a call doesn't go out or hasn't already gone out.
I already flipped over to the defensive depth chart for the Patriots. And look, I don't want to read too much into it, but again, it's all we have to go on. And there's no surprises on it by way of the names. What surprises me is the positions. It looks like it's now a base 4-3 in New England, that transition from 3-4 to 4-3 now complete. Two defensive ends, two defensive tackles, three linebackers. That's a 4-3. Are they now a base 4-3 team?
Yeah, and they kind of have been since really, honestly, like 2012 was when the transition kind of started, post-Giants Super Bowl after the Jason Pierre-Paul. He had such a great season. I really think that Jason Pierre-Paul altered the way the Patriots approach defense, and I think the Seattle Seahawks, it's been an incremental switch, but instead of being that reactive two-gap team, they're more of a penetrating team. Chandler Jones was a guy that they brought in as their JPP, and now they've brought in other kids, Zach Moore, who they drafted late as a Division II kid, is in the system now. They actually, Mike, they're going to do some bizarre things. This week we saw this kid, Zach Moore, playing on the nose, and he's a tall, lean, looks like a power forward. Jamie Collins was playing inside linebacker, and that was in a 3-4 set with five defensive backs on the field. So I've had people tell me that you're not going to believe what the Patriots do deployment-wise with Darrell Revis in the mix, and I think that we got a glimpse of it at least today. Excuse me, this week.
Well, there's been plenty of talk about this whole left side, right side thing that the Patriots are going to operate like the Seahawks do. Revis on the left side like Richard Sherman, Brandon Browner on the right side as he was in Seattle. Is that what you see happening, or will Revis be more mobile?
Much more mobile. I think that was exceedingly premature to make an observation on that earlier this week when it was reported that, hey, he's not moving around much. I think he's going to be all over the place. You're not going to have Aqib Talib in 2013 covering Charles Clay and Jimmy Graham all over the field as the Patriots did and then say, yeah, we're not going to do that with Revis.
Do we expect that Revis will be with the Patriots over the long haul? Because he's, as a practical matter, under a one-year contract. I think I saw something somewhere, maybe Jason Cole had the idea that the Patriots already are talking about ripping up this two-year contract, which is a practical matter, as a one-year deal, and extending it, replacing it with something else.
I think that that's all going to depend upon Revis, and I don't know him well enough to have been able to pinpoint what he wants in life. I mean, he's been a tremendous businessman, as good as anybody in the NFL in terms of being a player and understanding how to market his services and take risks when he needs to and cash in when he needs to and come back to the table when he has to, even if it's a little bit selfish. You sign a contract and then the next year you're holding on. The way the Jets operation worked was bizarre. But, you know, if he's in a different part of his career where he's looking to establish legacy, I think he's in a better spot than auctioning himself off next spring to whoever it is. I think that if you want to be the best corner ever, and, you know, Deion Sanders obviously moved around and got in the conversation, but Deion Sanders had rings to help establish himself as that greatest corner ever. And Revis has moved around. He's established himself. He's in as good a spot as any to get rings. Seattle, San Francisco, Denver being the other places that spring to mind as being good places. I think that if Revis is in that segment of his career, Mike, where he's into legacy building and still wants to make a lot of cash, I think the Patriots are obviously going to try and keep him around because he's foolishly good.
During this week that the Patriots have been engaged in joint workouts with Washington, the owner of the team, Daniel Snyder, has done multiple interviews defending actively and affirmatively the name of the team. And with ESPN's Outside the Lines, he says that other owners have been very, very supportive of the effort. He's gotten great support from within the league. But none of the other owners have spoken out and said, hey, I support Daniel Snyder. I support the name. There's nothing wrong with it. Why are we having this conversation? And given that the Patriots and the Washington team have been working out together, any insight, any thought on what Patriots owner, very influential in league circles, Robert Kraft, believes about this issue?
You know, he hasn't been down here. Kraft hasn't. And at the Super Bowl, after Roger Goodell did a soft shoe and a half around the question, in just an awkward way for a guy who can be extremely eloquent on other topics. I asked Kraft in a huddle what he thought about the name, and he also sidestepped around it. That was, you know, beyond his pay scale, so to speak. Probably the wrong thing to use with a billionaire. But after we wrapped up in the group interview, there were two of us standing there, and I think it was me and Mark Maskey from the Washington Post. He said, "What do you guys think?" And I asked the question initially, so I said, I think it's reprehensible in 2014 that, you know, you have so many different causes that are appealed to and people who claim they're taking offense, that when this one, which is quite obviously derogatory and invoking somebody's physical characteristic, is accepted by otherwise very politically correct people, that you would have that name. Long story short, I said, I think it's offensive. And he just looked at me and nodded, and indicating that he's not going to say anything. It's not his bailiwick, but he understands where someone would have that opinion. So that's as far as I can go in terms of characterizing what I thought he was indicating without getting inside his mind saying he thinks it's bull crap. But I think it makes him uncomfortable.
Yeah, I you know what? I feel like that's the next wave in all of this. Tom, regardless of where anybody stands on the issue, and people are entitled to their opinions, and I think it's important to have a reasonable and fair debate on this, I think the owners of the other teams are going to be pressed more and more aggressively to take a stand, to not avoid the question, but to take a stand. And people are going to invoke the fact that every team shares, to a certain extent, in revenue generated by the sales of merchandise bearing that name. So they all, the argument will go, they all are culpable, they are responsible at some point, at some level, in some way, for that name. They can't continue to be silent about it. Just say what you think. Everybody else, not everybody else, but it feels like everybody else, has stated their opinion. Why have the 31 other owners not done so? And that'll be intriguing to see what happens. Now, Kerry Williams of the Eagles,
let me,
I don't know
before if... Before we go to that, let me ask you this. Has anyone looked at how conscious Daniel Snyder was of the plight of Native Americans during his previous years as the owner of the Redskins? Because my feeling is it's quite probably a reactive thing. I mean, where were the playgrounds on the reservations that the Redskins were putting up in 2001, 2, and 3? Where was this great outcry from Daniel Snyder where he was doing sit-downs with news outlets and making sure that we were cognizant of the plight of Native Americans that he tried to parade around against with outside the lines? That, to me, would be a fascinating look, and I haven't done it. I'm bogged down with Brian Mallett here. But.
No, I think it's a very short documentary. There was nothing until the debate became... And look, the reason that the debate took off in 2013, the team decided to start to engage and respond to the scattered and disorganized opposition that was out there. I think the way the team has handled this from a PR perspective, and Snyder recently said the effort to be sensitive to the plight of Native Americans isn't PR. Well, that's good, because if it is PR, it's the worst PR I've ever seen, other than how the Ravens handled Ray Rice. But that's all a reaction, and everything they have done tends to, in my view, motivate the opposition, organize the opposition, and make the issue a legitimate subject of debate that isn't going to go away until the name goes away. One more question, one more topic before you go away until the next time you're on the program. Kerry Williams of the Eagles, he keeps saying that the Patriots are cheaters. Why are we having joint practices with the cheating Patriots? Does any of that stuff register on anyone's radar screen with the organization?
Always. It always hits, and it always sticks, because at this point in Bill Belichick's career, I think he's mystified as to how it's gone this many years down the road, and it is a primary talking point for so many people. And you talk about PR, the PR that the Patriots could have exercised in that first week probably would have had a significant impact. And you screw up a PR situation like they did, this is the fallout. 8 years later, some guy who probably couldn't even recount what the violation was or what the circumstances were is saying that they're cheaters. So, yeah, it registers, no doubt.
Yeah, and, you know, we are seven, 8 years removed from that. And there are plenty of people who continue to insist that the reason the Patriots haven't won a Super Bowl since Spygate is because they can't win a Super Bowl if they don't cheat. I don't buy it. A lot of people do. This year, 2014, the 10-year anniversary of the last Super Bowl victory. Is there a realistic chance? Are the Patriots on the short list of Super Bowl contenders? Not just to get there, but to win it.
Oh, very. I think very much so. You know, Jim Miller, who obviously is a Patriots alumni, works with SiriusXM. He was at the Patriots the other day, and he just came away shaking his head about how good they looked against the Redskins. One caveat, you have a new coach, you have a new program. Patriots have done these joint practices before. They ripped the Washington Redskins a new one this week. But, you know, when you look at defensively the things that they have in place and how far they went with the injuries they had last year, and I know Denver had plenty of injuries as well, so I'm not discounting that, but they've added pieces. There's familiarity on the offense, and I think that the injury problems are going to go away. I think that they still have what, in my estimation, is the best quarterback coach combination and the best tight end when he's healthy. So if they get good fortune, which they did not in 2013, I think that they would have to be right there with the other three.
Well, we'll see what happens. It all gets started soon enough. And tonight it gets started for the Patriots. It's the Ryan Mallett Showcase, as long as Jimmy Garoppolo does not poop the bed. Tom, thanks as always.
Ryan
and
Mallett.
Please don't poop the bed. And if you do, don't tell me about it.
All right, buddy.
All right, see you, buddy. There he is, Tom Curran. Highbrow conversation. Great stuff. We could go on and on and on, but we want to give you an opportunity to go on and on and on. Hopefully you won't if your call gets through. I noticed on Twitter that a guy named Sam, I believe, is on hold. Hang in there, Sam. We'll get to you after the break. We'll be right back. But you have to pick up your cell phone, and you have to dial. I got to give the number before I break. 888-237-5269. Give us a call. We'll be right back. This is PFT Live. It is PFT Planet time, boys and girls. We wrap most shows by wrapping with you. What do you have to say? What questions do you have? And we get rolling, as we always do, with a question from Twitter. First one comes from at RaiderKing69. Can Matt Schaub and the Raiders reach 500 this season, even with a tough schedule? Are you trolling me, RaiderKing69, or have you not watched the program? I had an argument the other night. Well, it was more of a spirited debate with a cousin of mine who's a big Raiders fan who has connected the dots to a 9-7 finish. And we went game by game. Well, I think we'll win with this one. Well, I think we'll win that one. I think we'll lose this one, yada, yada. Look at the schedule. Look at how crippling the schedule is. Two games against the Broncos, two games against the Chargers, two games against the Chiefs, all playoff teams in 2013. Games against the Seahawks, games against the 49ers, the Rams, the Cardinals, the Patriots. Even the Bills and the Jets were 8-8 last year. No, wait, the Dolphins and the Jets. The Bills were under 500, but they've got high hopes for 2014. There's only a couple of sub-500 teams, I believe, maybe three, on the schedule. The Bills, the Browns, and the Rams. And who cares if the Rams were sub-500? They're going to kick your butt. So it is going to be a long year for the Raiders. And, oh, by the way, four first games before the bye, three of them are like at 10:05 local time, which the numbers and studies have shown makes it harder for the West Coast teams to win. And one of the games is going to be in England at 10 o'clock local time. Not a good year for the Raiders coming. Of all the teams, they all have a chance to make the playoffs, I believe, except the Raiders. And speaking of the Raiders, Sam in Indiana, who's been patiently holding, you're on the program. What's up, Sam?
All right. Well,
And Sam waited all that time, and Sam's cell phone connection is dreadful. Sam, call back in, and let's see if we can get him back on. Let's go and pivot here now to Twitter. Question from at HeatherLake90. Do you guys really believe that the Jaguars will redshirt Blake Bortles no matter what? What if Chad Henne falls flat on his face? Look, I have believed that Blake Bortles is going to start week one, and that this is all part of that same game that the Browns and the Vikings are playing. Not that it's a game. It's the safe way to go. It's a smart way to go. You install the first-round rookie at number two, and then if he plays well enough, you elevate him to number one. But if you put him at number one and you put extra pressure on him and he doesn't play well, are you going to bench him? Are you going to admit that you were wrong by making him the starter? Are you going to potentially admit that you were wrong by drafting him in the first place? Now, I'm a little bit concerned that maybe my estimation is wrong because Bortles isn't getting any first-team reps in the preseason opener. There may be a receiver like Marquise Lee, and now I'm understanding that maybe there'll be an offensive lineman or two from the first-string unit. But you're putting the guy out there behind the second-string offensive line, second-string running back, second-string this, second-string that. They doesn't look like they're trying to get him ready to play with the first string. So maybe Chad Henne really does start the year, and there's a real risk in that because if Henne plays well and keeps playing well, when and how do you flip the switch over to Blake Bortles? Do you do it after the season? What if Chad Henne leads the Jaguars to the postseason? And I think that if Bortles doesn't start week one, he will get the job when Henne either gets injured or falls flat on his face. And if it doesn't happen, I know they would say that's a good problem to have. Any problem is a problem, good, bad, or otherwise. It's a problem if Henne ends up taking the team to the playoffs and the number three overall pick, who could have helped you be even better, could have been the difference between getting to the playoffs and winning the Super Bowl, that gets used on a guy that didn't play for you at all in his rookie season. Back to Twitter. Hopefully Sam's making an effort to hook back up with us again. But until then, at The Real Machine wants to know, what are the odds Josh Gordon gets his suspension reduced? Well, specifically in response to that question from The Real Machine, I have poked around a little bit. It's my understanding that as of right now, or at least as of about 45 minutes ago, there have been no discussions on a potential settlement of the Josh Gordon suspension, meaning that it's all or nothing. Zero games or 16 games. If I had to bet one way or the other, I think the NFL, despite all of the criticism that will inevitably flow from suspending Josh Gordon for a full year, for a variety of reasons, marijuana use legal in 2 of 22 states compared to the Ray Rice suspension, Jim Irsay not in this very aggressive substance abuse program where he's subject to a one-year suspension. Despite all that, I think if it goes to a ruling, the NFL is going to be inclined to apply the policy as written and suspend Josh Gordon for a full year. And there are no talks on a settlement, which means it's not going to be reduced. It's 16 or zero right now. If I were a betting man, and as far as anyone knows, I'm not, and I'm really not, I just say that for fun, I'd say that Gordon is going to be out for the full year, even though I think that's the wrong outcome, a very wrong outcome, which is not good for the kid, it's not good for the league, it's not good for the team, it's not good for anybody. What's good for us is to go to the phone lines. Jared in Baltimore, what's up, buddy?
Hey, what's going on, Mike?
How are you, man?
I'm doing good. I just want to get your opinion. What do you think from a statistical point, do you think Johnny Manziel's stats going to be for the Detroit game?
Oh, boy, I'd never thought of that. I don't know what kind of stats he's going to have, and I don't know that it matters because I think it's an inside job that he's going to be the starting quarterback. Now, you know, will his numbers be great? Probably not. He's going to get some reps with the first-team offense, which means he's going to be going against the first-team defense, which means even though he's got the benefit of the best blockers that the Browns have, Ziggy Ansah, Ndamukong Suh, Nick Fairley in a contract year, Suh in a contract year, it could get ugly for Johnny Manziel. But, I think that barring an injury or a pooping of the bed, to continue the Tom Curran quote of the day, Manziel's going to be the starter week one because that's what the boss wants. And the boss gets what he wants, or the boss starts firing people. And the boss wanted Manziel, and I think the boss wants Manziel week one. But I think the numbers will be nothing. I don't think it's going to be anything great. I think it's going to be, you know, just the stat lines for quarterbacks in these preseason games are never very impressive, especially early on because they don't play enough to really get into a rhythm. You know, 4 for 8 for 57 yards and an interception, you know, throw a dart. But I think the bigger issue is, how does he look? Does he look the part? And how does his speed and agility and mobility translate at the NFL level? Will he gain separation when he leaves the pocket? And will he get up when he gets hit by an NFL caliber defensive player? Back to the Twitter questions at DJNorris79. Any chance the Texans can have a winning record? Well, yeah, there's a chance. Look, the only team I'm willing to write off is the Oakland Raiders, which probably means they'll win the Super Bowl. But the Texans, you know, both the Texans in the AFC, the Falcons in the NFC, the thinking is it was an aberration last year. Well, I think it was more of an aberration for the Falcons. I think for the Texans, they have very deep and profound issues exacerbated by an exodus of free agents over the years. Do they really have that core that they need to be successful over the long term? Do you believe in the Texans at the quarterback position with Ryan Fitzpatrick? All due respect, i.e. here comes the insult, I don't. Andre Johnson getting toward the end of his career and all of that offseason consternation. J.J. Watt, he should get his long-term contract. Will that be a distraction? Can Jadeveon Clowney make an impact right out of the gates? Do they have enough behind them? Is their offensive line good enough? There's a lot of questions with the Texans. But when you consider their schedule, when you consider that they play 6 games in the AFC South, they play 4 games against the NFC East, they could have a winning record. They could. They also play the AFC North, which, you know, the AFC North has three very good teams, and who knows what will happen with the Browns. But I think the Texans can be a competitive team this year. And in a weak division, could they fatten up their record enough to get a wild card berth? Maybe. And if the Colts fall off in any way, and I don't think they will, I think the Colts win that division. But, yeah, I mean, the crazier things have happened, and I think the Texans are in that range of 31 teams, all but the Raiders, where 0-0, there's plausible hope. We get lucky. We avoid injuries. We catch a few breaks. The ball bounces our way. Next thing you know, it's late December, and you're a win or two away from getting to the postseason. We are not a question or two away from being done. We're done for the day. It went by fast. Today was fun. Not that any other day isn't fun. We'll have more fun tomorrow. After we have plenty of fun tonight watching fake football, exhibition football. Isn't it funny they don't call it exhibition? It's preseason. It's not the season. It's not real football. It's a glorified scrimmage in pads, and it's a run-through for – it's a rehearsal, basically, for what we're eventually going to see. But a lot will be determined, and for a lot of the guys on the roster, even though we don't know most of their names, we never will know most of their names unless they went to the college that we attended or were in some way related to or acquainted with them. Guys are going to be out there working hard in the second half of these games to try to make the kind of impact that will give them an opportunity to migrate from the 90-man roster to the 53-man roster. So important games when it comes to winning jobs for all of those guys. 37 are going to be gone from every team. For those guys, this is as real as it gets. So that's the best pitch I can make to watch the preseason. But we're going to watch it anyway because it's football, it's on TV, and there ain't nothing else on. Except on NBCSN at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Pro Football Talk. Tune in then. We'll get you ready for tonight's games with all sorts of stuff. We got a lot of stuff to cover in an hour. I'm not sure we can get to it. That's one reason to watch. Will we actually get to everything we want to get to? We'll get to everything that we can get to tomorrow at noon Eastern Time. See you back here again tomorrow. Check us out around the clock at ProFootballTalk.com. Have a good one.